this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Tracking Our Millionaires. The number of millionaires in North Carolina jumped 22% in 2016. Most of the wealth creation tracked back to metro counties. And that's the headline on the cover. The story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline. Wealth Central. Million-dollar filers had a net tax liability of $151.6 million in Wake County, $23 million in Durham County, and $35 million in Orange County. And this article is written by Dan Hedrick. There's that great scene from the 1997 spy action comedy film, Austin Powers' International Man of Mystery, when the villain, Dr. Evil, cryogenically frozen in 1967, returns 30 years later to hatch a dastardly plan involving a stolen nuclear weapon. Here's the plan, says Dr. Evil, played by Mike Myers. We get the warhead, and we hold the world ransom for $1 million. Ahem. Dr. Evil's one-eyed henchman, number two, played by Robert Wagner, gently interjects. Don't you think maybe we should ask for more than $1 million? $1 million isn't exactly a lot of money these days. Maybe a cool million isn't that much money for some people, but just being able to call yourself a millionaire, that is, having that much in investable assets, still confers a certain aura that about 4.5% of North Carolina's 3.9 million households enjoy. Triangle Business Journal pulled data from the North Carolina Department of Revenue for 2014, the most recent data available, to track where the state's millionaires live. It's a glimpse into the state's pockets of wealth and underscores that the bulk of the state's millionaire households live in the urban areas around Charlotte, followed by the Triangle and the Triad. While millionaires are a small percentage of the population, they have an outsized impact as they invest in companies, support restaurants, and pump cash into community events. The Department of Revenue reported $1,147 million plus tax returns for Wake County in 2014, the second highest number of millionaires in the state, behind Mecklenburg County, which had $2,009 million returns. Affluent Orange County had $255 million dollar returns, and Durham County, 182. Those millionaires can put tons of cash into the local economies. Research shows the million-dollar filers had a total tax liability of $151.6 million in Wake County and $35 million in Orange County. For example, those two counties were also among the state's most prosperous overall. In Orange County, the average income per return was $93,927, the highest in the state. Chatham County was second at $81,004, and Wake third at $79,984. But the data also show the wide disparity in income levels that exists in North Carolina. For example, many counties just beyond the Triangle's borders had a low number of millionaire filers. Nash County had only 39 million-dollar filers, Henderson County 32, and Wilson County 26. And in some counties, the gap between the rich and poor is significant. Macon County, tucked in the mountains of the state, had the highest tax liability for million-dollar filers at a whopping $322,124, but that was the average of only 12 filers. In eastern North Carolina's Pamlico County, the million-dollar filers had an average tax liability of $166,901, but there were only nine of them. They feel like $1 million. So, who is worth $1 million, and what conclusions can be drawn about the wealthiest class? David Dobbs, Vice President of Investments at Wells Fargo Advisors in Chapel Hill, has built a client roster of about 370 households in more than 20 states over the past 29 years. He has learned that wealth means different things to different people, but one view typically succeeds. Many of my clients who are millionaires or multimillionaires come from simple backgrounds, Dobbs says. Most have led a pretty simple life, worked hard and invested, and didn't spend a lot. Dobbs' own parents fall into that category, he says. They didn't inherit it. His dad worked his whole life and saved. His mother stayed home, raised four children, and budgeted the money. Dobbs recalls years ago when he was a young man in his 20s asking his father to help him buy a muscle car he wanted badly. "He didn't say anything to me," Dobbs says. "I don't think he even acknowledged that I had asked the question." Looking back, Dobbs says his dad was right. Volatility in the world and destabilizing events that surprise investors represent the greatest risks to wealth, he says, and those who are patient, frugal, and focused on the long term tend to do well. Even without economic shocks, being a millionaire takes on a new meaning when basic things just cost more than they used to. With an average annual inflation rate of 4.83% over the past 40 years, you'd need $6.2 million today to buy what $1 million could buy in the 1970s. If you decided at the age of 30 that you wanted to be a millionaire by 65, you'd need to save and invest $2,164 per month at an annual growth rate of 6%. Once you hit retirement, you'd need $1.25 million tucked away to provide you with the not-so-necessarily princely sum of $4,166 per month before taxes and assuming you don't take more than 4% of your principal each year. But Dobbs says just having a million isn't the goal for most investors. Most people ask, "How much do I need to maintain my lifestyle?" he says. Defining the dividing line. Indeed, maintaining lifestyle, rather than simply looking at income, is emerging as the basis of a new way economists are beginning to measure wealth and to understand how it accumulates and concentrates. Income used to reflect your ability to have a certain lifestyle, says Maureen Berner, an economist and professor at UNC Chapel Hill School of Government and co-author of a 2016 report documenting poverty in North Carolina. Food on the table, roof over your head, clothes for the children, that sort of thing. She says the conversation is shifting to ask why income is the indicator. Why don't we just measure whether or not people can have their lifestyle, she says. A better measurement is what Berner calls material deprivation. It's just a highfalutin term basically saying, can you meet your basic needs in your household? Shelter, food, heat. Material deprivation speaks to how hard it is to get out of poverty. Traditional measurements underestimate truly struggling households. In North Carolina, wealth separates along stark urban-rural geographical lines. The state's urban centers, the Triangle, Charlotte, and the Triad, have benefited the most from the post-recession recovery, while rural area populations are struggling, according to NC State University economist Michael Walden. There are benefits to the region to having millionaires and billionaires, Walden says. These people have the opportunity to engage in civic activities based on one's self-interest, like endow a museum. They have the ability and resources, and they have an image to maintain. But there remains a stark disparity in North Carolina. Statewide poverty rates exceed the national average and are still 15% higher than before the recession hit in 2007, according to NC Policy Watch. And even among the wealthy, North Carolina ranks near the bottom nationally in terms of millionaires per capita, dropping last year from 43rd to 44th, according to Phoenix Marketing International Global Wealth Monitor 2015. Growing wages remains a priority for North Carolina's leaders. Even as economists track a widening gap between haves and have-nots, policies that keep wages low remain a key economic strategy North Carolina lawmakers use to attract industry for economic growth. North Carolina's economy continues to be strong and robust, says Representative Nelson Dollar, Republican Wake County, senior chairman of the North Carolina House Appropriations Committee. I think maybe a better measure of income is the median income rather than average income. Median income growth in North Carolina over the last 5 years is pretty strong, one of the strongest in the country. According to the Census ACS one-year survey, median family income for North Carolina was $47,830 in 2015, compared with the median U.S. family income of $55,775. The family income data for 2016 will be released in September. Since 2012, when median family income was $45,150, real median family income for North Carolina has grown about 3%. Per capita income was lower in 2015, $26,801, than it was in 2005, $27,330. Income gap an issue for North Carolina. From the perspective of the General Assembly, Dollar says, policies that focus on infrastructure and education represent some of the most effective ways of addressing the economic needs of rural communities. We know there are a number of smaller cities in rural areas, particularly in the east and in the western part of the state, that continue to struggle and continue to have challenges, Dollar says. The wealthier urban areas have their challenges as well. In the Charlotte area, for example, 54% of the children in public school receive free and reduced price lunch. In Guilford County, it's 58.7%. Wake County fares better at 38.6% of children needing help with meals, but not far to the north in Warren County, the number is 86.5%, and in Durham County, nearly 7 out of 10 school children qualify as hungry. Some counties in the east and to the west hit percentages in the 80s and 90s. The state average is 56%. UNC Chapel Hill's Berner says those numbers have significant implications for business. Successful business folks rely on a solid workforce, Berner says. If I were running a business and looking at my 10-year business plan, a second grader is going to graduate in 10 years, and over half are coming from hungry households. Our future workforce is mostly kids coming from hungry households. Berner's report points to growing pockets of intense poverty within the urban high-growth concentrations of wealth, where housing and food costs are rising. If the line in the food pantry is getting longer, with more families needing more, it's probably an indicator your community is struggling, Berner said. Folks are scrambling to try to understand what the heck is going on. More millionaires ahead. While North Carolina's percentage of millionaires runs close to the bottom nationally, a Boston Consulting Group report last year projected that more than 3 million additional people over the next 3 years in the United States will be added to the 8 million or so who are millionaires today, fueled mostly by inheritance from older generations. Bloomberg calls it the largest generational transfer of wealth in history, but it's not really a transfer. The report illustrates how wealth stays concentrated among the already affluent. According to research by Spectrum Group, more than 73% of surveyed investors under the age of 50 with assets above $25 million said inheritance factored into their success. Inheritances of varying degrees play fairly important roles in Dobbs' client portfolios at Wells Fargo Advisors, and for many of his younger clients, discipline and financial education will be crucial to maintaining the lifestyles they seek, he said. I'd like to think that we've got more educated investors than in the past, but not necessarily, he says. I think in this world today, you've got a lot of people driving Lexuses and BMWs who ought to be driving Chevys and Fords. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. The main headline, event celebrates art, culture of France. Raleigh will get a taste of France this month with a celebration of French art and culture that includes art as well as wine and cheese. Called France Pavilion, the event comes to Raleigh after previously appearing in New York, Miami, and Washington. The Raleigh exhibition will be February 9 through 12 at Market Hall downtown. France Pavilion is a showcase of 11 contemporary French artists, including well-known sculptor Richard Orlinsky. Some of the works displayed are from established artists and some from emerging artists. The exhibition is open to the public for free and will include a variety of talks and events. A VIP reception on the evening of February 10 will include Mayor Nancy McFarlane and Louis de Carrel, the Consul General of France for the Southeast. One of Raleigh's sister cities is Compiègne, France. Peace Prize goes to International Focus. Congratulations are in order for International Focus, the Raleigh organization best known for putting on the International Festival every fall. International Focus has been awarded the 2017 North Carolina Peace Prize from the Peace Corps. The prize includes a grant of $1,000 and a commemorative vase made in Seagrove. It's an acknowledgement of the consistent work we do for North Carolina and the world, really, says Leela Beckery of International Focus. International Focus looks to highlight the region's diverse international community. Beckery says International Focus is involved in about 30 exchange programs each year, in addition to the International Festival, which attracts around 20,000 people each year. An official ceremony for the Peace Prize will be held in March. Tracking travelers, now key concern for companies. Raleigh's Travel Management Partners is no stranger to the travel game. President and CEO John Lewis, 66, has been involved in corporate travel since decades ago when he lived in Baltimore. He moved to Raleigh and started a company in 1994 with 9 people. It now has 118 employees and customers across the nation. We do approximately 4 or 5% of sales from Raleigh, he says. The company now does $350 million annually in total sales volume, up from $40 million in 1994. The fourth quarter of 2016, Lewis says, was slow with the election looming. People were holding back, he adds. One part of the business that is growing, and rapidly, is what the industry refers to as duty of care. That's the concept of employers doing all they can to track their employees and let them know of any problems while they are traveling. That includes not only weather-related events such as hurricanes, but increasingly, violent eruptions. Lewis says TMP has helped its clients track employees for years, but he wanted more, so in 2014, TMP launched a web-based product that allows travel managers to track employees easily. The dashboard of the reporting tool shows where all the traveling employees are located, their travel schedules, and whether the employees are in or headed toward dangerous locations. Senior Vice President of Operations Eddie Albertson, who oversaw the site's development, says it pulls in feeds from sources such as the U.S. State Department and other official sources, as well as media outlets. Lewis says that only a few years ago, about 10% of his clients were using the Duty of Care product. Now that number is 30% and rising rapidly. It's going to produce a good revenue stream, but it will help us secure long-term relationships with existing clients, he says. Big idea, help North Carolina seafood industry. Durham Entrepreneurial Support Organization, NC Idea, is funneling cash into seafood, sort of. NC Idea just awarded a grant to the Marine Biotechnology Center of Innovation in Wilmington. The cash is earmarked for MBCOI's role in Fish 2.0 2017, an international business competition connecting seafood-related businesses with investors. Specifically, MBCOI is partnering with UNC Wilmington to draw shellfish entrepreneurs from across the Southeast to a regional workshop on pitching their businesses. The grant is part of $1.25 million the group has committed to organizations throughout the state that support entrepreneurs. UNC Chapel Hill doctors fight bone marrow disease. A team of physicians at UNC Chapel Hill is fighting a rare bone marrow disease that can cause damage to vital organs. The disease, AL, amyloidosis, can lead to conditions such as chronic fatigue and irregular heartbeat, as well as kidney disease and failure. There are between 10,000 and 15,000 new cases of AL amyloidosis diagnosed annually in the United States and European Union each year, and there are currently no approved therapies for this disease, said Dr. Sasha Tuchman, director of the amyloidosis program at UNC Chapel Hill. I think of this like the fuel pump in a car. If the pump gets clogged up, the engine doesn't run well. Amyloidosis clogs up vital organs in humans, damaging those organs. Tuchman and his colleagues at UNC Chapel Hill are enrolling patients as part of a global clinical trial for an investigational drug candidate, NEOD-001, from biotechnology company Prothena, which has locations in Dublin and San Francisco. And finally, under a section called New Leader for Partnership, Ryan Coombs, the 37-year-old hired to be the new executive director of the Research Triangle Regional Partnership, will likely need to draw upon lessons he's learned on both the baseball diamond and at NC State University and as a Senate aide on Capitol Hill for his next assignment. In the 7 months since the leadership shakeup at RTRP, following the retirement of its longtime president and departure of his presumed successor, the partnership has been operating with a skeleton staff under the guidance of a consultant, retired Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce President Harvey Schmidt. The board was spending much of its time lobbying to hold on to its membership that had grown to as many as 16 counties in 2014. 12 of those counties, including Wake and Durham, have since renewed their financial support for RTRP, but all likely will be watching to see what Coombs does next. He says he's hoping to find that middle ground. I'll be working with economic developers and local leaders on how to maximize our efforts to bring jobs to the area, he says. It's a dream job for me, actually. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Retail Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline, Raleigh developers add land, expand vision for major project on Peace Street. John Kane and Cross Williams, the Raleigh developers behind the proposed 12-story Smoky Hollow building project at the corner of Peace and West Streets, are making even bigger plans for an already ambitious project for downtown Raleigh. Kane confirms that he and Williams have assembled more land around the 4.2-acre Smoky Hollow site, but he says no firm development plans are in place yet for any of the new properties. County real estate records show that entities controlled by either Kane or Williams paid close to $15 million in November and December for the land that would nearly double the total acreage of the project so far. Since 2008, the partnership has paid a combined $21.4 million for buildings and lots in the neighborhood in the neighborhood bound by Peace, West, Johnson, and Harrington Streets that encompass their Smoky Hollow project. The project's name is a nod to the blue-collar neighborhood that used to occupy that area before redevelopment in the 1960s. City planners approved development plans for the first building at Smoky Hollow in December and include allowances for up to 616 apartment units and a 51,300-square-foot grocery store. Sources say a public supermarket will anchor the building. When you go in with these things, you try to get all that you can because as soon as someone figures out what you're buying, the prices go up and pricing in downtown Raleigh is tough, Kane says. But it's good for the market, and it's good that the market can pay that. Kane confirms that he also has under contract to buy three more properties at 413, 437, and 441 Harrington Street from Cary developer Greg Sandruder, where a six-story multifamily development was approved in 2014. However, Kane is likely to scrap the apartment plan for a larger building and capitalize on the zoning designation that allows for construction up to 12 stories high. We're looking at that whole area, Kane says. We know kind of what we're doing at West and Peace Streets, and we're trying to figure out the rest of it and how it fits. Construction on the first building at Smoky Hollow could break ground by late summer 2017. Delivery will be timed with the construction timeline of the North Carolina Department of Transportation's bridge replacement project at the Capitol Boulevard interchange with Peace Street. Grub Ventures seeking to expand Dock 1053 success with acquisition of Peden Steel site. Raleigh real estate developer Gordon Grubb is among the first to admit it wasn't his idea to go outside of downtown Raleigh and buy a gritty old grocery warehouse that didn't seem to have much hope left in it. He tosses that credit to Sam Crutchfield, Grubb Ventures' director of leasing and acquisitions. Crutchfield, though, won't take full credit either. But in recent months, as the rent roll at the 183,700-square-foot Dock 1053 project on Whitaker Mill Road has filled, Crutchfield is looking like a soothsayer. With a waiting list of potential users calling about renting space at Dock 1053, Crutchfield says he has turned most people away. "We were full," he says, and after saying that out loud a few times, I thought, maybe we should look again at Peden Steel, the 19-acre industrial property across the street. On January 19, Grubb Ventures acquired the Peden Steel site for $10 million. Crutchfield says for the time being, they are fine with Waste Management, the current tenant, staying there. That'll give Grubb Ventures time to develop a more finite plan, hinting that a future plan could also include an urban-style loft apartment community. And in a section called Coming, new restaurants include pizza and burgers. The owners of Northridge Shopping Center on Falls of Neuse Road in North Raleigh have confirmed three new tenants for the spring. An O2 Fitness Club will move into the 26,667-square-foot anchor space on the center's lower level. A new Zoe's Kitchen and Chopped Creative Salad Company will also open. Lotsa Stone Fired Pizza has announced plans to make its North Carolina debut at 100 West Franklin Street in Chapel Hill. The fast casual pizza chain is expected to open in the spring. The owners of Al's Burger Shack in Chapel Hill are opening a new restaurant in Carrboro. Mel's Commissary and Luncheonette, Melody and Al Bowers plan to open in mid-March at 109 West Main Street in Carrboro. And Going is another section. And that starts off with the headline, Well-known chef Gregory Ham closing P.G. Wirth's. Respected Raleigh-area chef and culinary instructor Gregory Ham is closing his P.G. Wirth's restaurant and market in downtown Raleigh by mid-February. Ham, who opened P.G. Wirth's at the 927 West Morgan Apartments in 2015, says he is starting to make plans for travel and retirement. In Raleigh's North Ridge Shopping Center, the Tribeca Tavern restaurant at the entrance has closed. The upscale and Asian cuisine restaurant at the Arboretum in Cary has closed. The restaurant was owned by Ann and Jim Goodnight and was an extension of their Umstead Hotel and Heron's restaurant brand. And finally, in a section under Milestones, Raymond James to join Bank of North Carolina in new building. Developers of the three-story 3515 Glenwood building that's nearing completion just inside Raleigh's Beltline have signed their first tenant, bringing in the local office of the Raymond James & Associates Incorporated Financial Advisors. Raymond James will be taking about 12,000 square feet on the second floor of the 75,000 square foot building. It will be joining Bank of North Carolina, which acquired the property in 2015, with a first-floor office space at 3515 Glenwood. And now we turn to the On Tech and Transportation page, written by Lauren Onasorge. The main headline, Fiber Expands Reach in Raleigh. Nearly 6 months after launching service in Morrisville, Alphabet subsidiary Google Fiber is open for business in Raleigh. Specifically, it launched its high-speed service in Raleigh's North Hills Midtown area February 1. We've seen tremendous response in Morrisville, and we expect the same tremendous response in North Hills Midtown, says Eric Garr, the executive responsible for Google Fiber's Triangle operation. He wouldn't be specific about how many people have signed up for the service in the Triangle, but says all is going according to plan. Additional geographic launches will all depend on how long it takes to finish North Hills Midtown, he says. But Google Fiber's plans haven't gone so smoothly in other regions. In October, the company said it would pause operations in most of the cities it had announced as potential locales for the service. Layoffs were announced as the company paused plans in metros such as Chicago, Dallas, and Phoenix. Blair Levin, former director of the National Broadband Plan, says the reasoning behind Google's nationwide rollout reduction is pretty simple. It's hard and expensive, he says, a fiber implementation. It's not an accident that there are very few companies willing to take that risk. As Google Fiber slows, what you're going to see is a slowdown by the other companies offering improved speeds and lower prices, so the advantage to North Carolina just increases, actually. But the rollout isn't coming without some frustrations in Triangle communities where Google Fiber contractors have received dozens of violation notices from metros such as Raleigh and Durham. In addition to acquiring multiple permits from government agencies across the region, Google Fiber contractors use heavy boring equipment to dig out trenches for the fiber, and the equipment comes in contact with utility lines on occasion, disrupting services and causing aesthetic issues in yards. All we can continue to promise is we'll care about each complaint, Garr says, noting that there's an 800 number for construction issues. This is hard work. It's a big infrastructure upgrade for the Triangle. Garr, however, isn't worrying about his firm's nationwide fiber plans. He says his job is to, quote, keep our heads down and keep building, unquote. When the company announced its Triangle Fiber plans, Morrisville, Cary, Raleigh, Durham, Garner, Chapel Hill, and Carrboro were all named as targets. Garr declined to say where in the Triangle Google Fiber would target next, but it's already seeing heavy competition. Durham startup continues to raise cash. A year from its inception, a Durham real estate technology startup has raised more than $3.4 million in financing. Golden Key, which used to be called SoloPro, disclosed a new $1.75 million raise this month. CEO Tommy Sauer says the financial support speaks to the demand that's out there. Golden Key has developed what it dubs an on-demand agent digital marketplace. By using Golden Key's site or app, buyers and sellers can choose from a selection of customized packaged agent services, paying only for the agent assistance they need. I think more and more home buyers and sellers are realizing just because they want some help buying or selling, it shouldn't mean they have to fork over half their home equity to commissions, he says. These fees really add up. More than 100 agents in the Triangle have already signed on to the platform, and they're making supplemental income as a result, Sauer says. Some agents made more than $10,000 last year through the service, he adds. The money will go toward three things: the platform, expanding the team, and continuing the nationwide expansion, he says. Sauer says Golden Key has agents in more than 53% of the nation's zip codes. We're not like Uber, where you have to go market by market, he says. There are already licensed, trained agents in every market. It's really letting everyone know this exists. According to the company, the sum comes from a group of investors that includes Lowe's Ventures and NFX Guild. It's the second cash infusion the 16-person company has received from Lowe's. Sauer says the new name was about creating a brand that speaks to the agents and consumers. The key is traditionally associated with the home, but it unlocks things, Sauer says. We are unlocking efficiency in this market. And in a section called Closer Look, Kansas City International Airport, MCI, has identified Raleigh-Durham International Airport as its next nonstop priority. Despite the fact that nearly 94 passengers travel between the two airports each day, no nonstop exists, at least not right now. Joe McBride, spokesman for MCI, says his team has identified the route as a top domestic priority. Meetings have already taken place with multiple carriers to talk specifically about this route opportunity, he says. Raleigh firm sells majority share. Accel KKR, the same private equity firm that acquired Morrisville software firm SideQuest last year, is adding another Triangle firm to its portfolio. Raleigh-based FM Systems announced California-based Accel KKR had acquired a majority stake in its business. Financial terms were not disclosed. Michael Schley, founder and CEO of FM Systems, says the company explored options for more than a year. The company hired Vaquero Capital LLC to assist its search for an investor. Through that relationship, it explored more than 40 potential investment partners before teaming up with Accel KKR. We had a lot of interest, and a key factor was not just the money, but the quality of the company, he says. The deal with Accel KKR not only kept the management team in place, it kept Schley on as an owner. While Accel KKR is now the majority owner of FM Systems, Schley says he retained a significant minority stake. The company has about 100 employees worldwide. Two-thirds of that headcount is in Raleigh, where Schley expects to hire 10 more. The company had more than $10 million in 2016 revenue, he says. The company provides web-based software aimed at helping companies manage their space, everything from occupancy to maintenance to leases. And finally, record-breaking year at RDU, led by Delta American. New numbers give more color on how individual carriers, from Delta Airlines to Southwest Airlines to American Airlines, contributed to a record-breaking year at Raleigh-Durham International Airport. In total, the airport had 11,049,143 passengers fly in and out of its gates. Here's how the top five carriers ranked in terms of in-plane passengers at RDU for 2016. Delta, 1,654,356. American, 1,508,962. Southwest, 1,161,777. United, 686,791. And JetBlue, 259,086. And now we turn to the On Life Sciences page, written by Jennifer Henderson. The main headline, Morrisville's Lucerno Dynamics seeks to improve quality of PET CAT scans. For Lucerno Dynamics, determining when and how PET CAT scan infections go awry is a feat that can't be ignored. The company has developed a device to detect and monitor so-called infiltrations in radio tracer injections, which are designed to accumulate at areas of concern in the body. Infiltrations, which occur when radio tracer accumulates in the wrong place, can significantly reduce the quality of images produced by PET and CAT scans. Think, for instance, the staging of a cancer patient's tumor or how well that tumor has been responding to treatment. Last year, Lucerno raised $6.3 million to aid in achieving this feat, listed its LoRa system device with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and launched its 10,000-patient LoRa QI study meant to determine what the real-world rate of infiltrations is today in the U.S., according to CEO Ron Latanz. Roanoke, Virginia-based Carilion Clinic, which serves close to 1 million patients in Virginia, is the first site initiated in the study, according to Lucerno. The company expects to announce roughly a dozen participants, including academic and cancer centers, community hospitals, and mobile units, later this year. There have been a few centers that have looked at this issue on their own, says Latanz, including Ohio State University, St. Louis University, and Spain's University of Santiago. According to Lucerno, these sites have presented results on over 2,000 patients, and the infiltration rates have averaged between 9% and 21%. But Latanz says, as far as we can tell, there has never been a multi-center study trying to see what the real rate of infiltrations is across the U.S. The LoRa system allows for determining and monitoring of infiltrations during the 60-minute uptake period in PET CAT scans, when radio tracer circulates throughout the body and concentrates in particular areas, says Latanz, rather than looking at a single snapshot alone. No hospital can tell you today what the quality of the injection process is, says Latanz, adding he believes infiltrations are being underreported. Although infiltrations can present serious problems when it comes to patient care, as well as treatment efficiencies for providers, Latanz says it's important to note that just because the patient has had an infiltration, it doesn't necessarily mean their quality of care has been compromised. For instance, an initially underreported tumor due to infiltration, shown on a follow-up scan to be getting worse, would still indicate that a patient needs further treatment because they're not responding, explains Latanz. However, the question remains, if a tumor shows improvement on a follow-up scan, is that accurate or due to an infiltration? The LoRa QI study will focus on telling hospitals, here's your rate, here's what's contributing to your rate, here are the things you may want to consider changing so your rate gets better, says Latanz. The study will then detect and monitor infiltrations at sites after they've made certain improvements, he says. Latanz says Lucerno has enough funding to carry it through the study and selling the device. BioCryst plans for a European launch of injectable flu therapy. Durham-based BioCryst Pharmaceuticals is preparing to launch its injectable flu therapy, Paramivir, in Europe. The drug has already been approved in the U.S. and a number of other countries. The company announced January 30 that the European Medicines Agency has accepted its marketing authorization application for Paramivir, officially kicking off its review for approval in the European Union, as well as Iceland and Norway. Sequeris UK Limited will commercialize the therapy in the EU. Paramivir, marketed as Rapivab, received U.S. Food and Drug Administration approval back in 2014, and Rapivab is spelled R-A-P-I-V-A-B. The therapy has also been approved in Japan and Taiwan, licensed as Rapiacta, as well as in Korea, licensed as Paramiflu, according to BioChrist. Earlier this year, the company announced that Health Canada had approved Rabivab. Novan stock plummets on mixed Phase 3 results. Shares of Durham-based Novan were down more than 75% January 27, trading just north of $4 after the company's announcement of mixed results from Phase 3 trials of SB204 for the treatment of acne. Our team has not yet received the full data set, and we intend to provide an update on the SB204 program after our complete analysis, said Nate Stasko, president and CEO of Novan, in a statement. Novan said it believes that its cash on hand is sufficient to fund operations at least through the end of 2017, of which the allocation of capital will be dependent upon further assessment of the SB204 Phase 3 trial results and data from other platform programs. Two ECU student housing units sold to Campus Advantage of Austin, Texas. A pair of student housing properties near East Carolina University, University Manor and Pirates Place, have been acquired by Austin, Texas-based Campus Advantage in partnership with Los Angeles-based Sabin Real Estate. The ECU properties have been well maintained and staffed over time, says Jennifer Cassidy, Senior Vice President of Asset Management at Campus Advantage, which recently took over management of the properties. There are opportunities for updating them as well, she says. Campus Advantage and Sabin scooped up the properties from American Campus Communities in November as part of a 19-property, $508 million deal. BDSI confident after reacquiring Belbuca. Following the reacquisition of licensing rights to its pain management product, Belbuca, from Endo Pharmaceuticals last month, BioDelivery Sciences International anticipates profitability sooner than originally anticipated. On January 6, we inherited a product on very favorable financial terms that ended the year with a $30 million gross sales run rate, BDSI President and CEO Mark Sergo said February 1 during an investor event in New York. This added revenue growth will allow us to bring our commercial business to profitability by the end of the first quarter, he said, noting that the company previously said it expected a profitability by the end of the year with its opioid dependence drug, Bunavail. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, the editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Could Real Estate Save Universities' Endowments? When we wrote the cover story last week on how local universities are making deeper investments in commercial real estate, it was clear that almost all campuses across the nation are looking at their real estate portfolios and figuring out better ways to monetize them. And endowment numbers released this week by the National Association of College and University Business Owners, NACUBO, and Common Fund proved that the strategy to go deep into direct and indirect real estate investing will only accelerate. That's primarily because university investment officers did not do a good job in terms of endowment returns last year. The only saving grace really was investing in real estate. Endowment returns for the fiscal year ended June 2016 for 805 U.S. colleges were an anemic 1.9%, the worst in 7 years. This year's long-term return figure is well below the median, 7.4% that most institutions report they need to earn in order to maintain their endowment's purchasing power after spending, inflation, and investment management costs, NACUBO official said. But the devil is in the details. Collectively, universities had negative returns in domestic and foreign stocks, hedge funds, energy, commodities, and junk bonds. Some, like energy and commodities, lost big, down 7% or more for the year. The biggest average gain for those universities was in private equity real estate investment in non-campus properties, 7.1%. Why is this important, especially for the Triangle, where higher education is joined by healthcare and government as one of the three economic pillars? It's because universities cannot execute their vision if their endowments are not growing. Duke University's endowment fell 6.9%, and UNC Chapel Hill's numbers dropped 3.3%. NC State University's endowment inched up 1.5% in the last fiscal year, one of the few schools to see an increase in ROI last year. We do not have the breakdown of the investment category returns for specific universities yet, but I am guessing NCSU had a good year in terms of real estate returns, especially as it grows its Centennial campus and Hillsboro Street holdings with private developers. That should offer a blueprint for the Big Three, sitting on some $8 billion plus in building and land value across the triangle. And now we'll turn to some general news stories in the Triangle Business Journal. First, we have an article written by Dane Huffman. The title, Triangle Considers Translucent Stadium Roof in MLS Expansion Bid. The Triangle's bid for Major League Soccer, filed January 31, includes renderings of a 22,000-seat stadium with a translucent roof that expansion bid leader Steve Malik describes as breathtaking. Malik changed the name of the Carolina Railhawks to the North Carolina Football Club and launched a pursuit of the top level of American soccer. MLS plans to expand by two teams this year and then another two in a round after that. MLS said 12 cities are bidding for the four expansion franchises. Malik says the bid was all sealed up and ready to go despite a tight timeline. Malik announced the expansion bid on December 6. He says his group would continue to give MLS more information as the expansion process evolved. Malik says the triangle gave MLS three alternatives for a stadium site. One is upgrading the current Wake Med Soccer Park. Malik would not reveal the other two options, but one presumably would be a site in downtown Raleigh, as North Carolina FC officials have consistently said MLS prefers an urban location and covets millennials. He is confident that excitement for the bid will spike when fans see the renderings of the stadium. They will get people super fired up, he says. One option is having a translucent roof. Malik had originally targeted a 24,000-seat stadium, but decided to reduce the size and add more club seats. He says the $150 million stadium could eventually expand to 28,000 seats. Still, the Triangle faces a tough and expensive climb. The expansion fee is a whopping $150 million, more than the $140 million Jerry Richardson paid for the NFL's Carolina Panthers. And the Triangle needs a stadium. Malik said he is working with an investment bank and looking to add investors. But Malik points to demographics that fit the MLS profile. And Hill Caro, CEO of the Triangle Sports Commission, says Malik's group has put the Triangle at the forefront of the MLS conversation. Obviously, they've been working really quickly, Caro says. He also says the Triangle is definitely recognized by soccer leaders as being a place with support for the sport. Caro says the Triangle Sports Commission has helped evaluate stadium sites, and he says Jimmy Goodman, vice president of Capital Broadcasting, is chairing a committee looking to garner corporate and public support. And in news around the state, North Carolina firm expects progress in nuclear power business. Jim McCann, the new president and chief operating officer of Kernersville-based Columbiana Hi-Tech, said that he expects significant growth this year for the local manufacturer of nuclear power storage containers and systems, with plans to eventually construct a 100,000-square-foot plant that would double the size of the firm's Triad headquarters. McCann said that there are no imminent plans to build, but that the company is prepared to do so on a 10-acre parcel of land adjacent to the firm's $11 million 100,000-square-foot manufacturing facility. Our plan is to be prepared for future growth, and I think we have room to grow without changing a lot here, he said. We have 100,000 square feet now, and the plan would be to double. The business demand will dictate that, he says. Three North Carolina golf courses make list of best in the U.S. North Carolina is home to three of the top 50 golf courses in the United States, according to the editors of Golf Advisor, a website that rates and reviews golf courses. The best of list was compiled from input from tens of thousands of golfers who submitted more than 100,000 reviews. The website states that the rankings are based on the opinions of average golfers, not industry experts or members of golf panels. According to Golf Advisor, the three North Carolina courses that made its top 50 list are number 14, Thistle Golf Club in Sunset Beach. Thistle is everything everyone here has said it would be, said one golfer. Number 22, Cedar Brook Country Club in Elkin. Green fees range from $23 to $39. For the cost, I cannot imagine there is a better golf value in North Carolina, one golfer wrote. And number 25, Scotch Hall Preserve in Mary Hill in Birdie County. The course was designed by Arnold Palmer. As a news release said, the top 50 overall courses in the U.S. best of list is reflective of what golfers had to say based on their rounds played in 2016, and more specifically, how all facets of the experience stacked up based on the money they paid to play. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to a question and answer column titled, He'll Listen, Then Lead Creation of Raleigh's New Dick's Park. And this is written by Cameron Snipes, and it's a question and answer column with Sean Malone. And first, there's a box with information called Closer Look. Name, Sean Malone, age 47, title, President and CEO, Dick's Parks Conservancy. Education, BFA in Theater from the University of Southern California. Master's in Business from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Post-professional certificates from executive education programs at the schools of business at Harvard University, University of Michigan, and University of Texas Austin through the Chief Executive Program of National Arts Strategies. Family, wife, Erica Kent, daughters, Lily, 9, and Emma, 14. First job, counselor and teaching assistant at a summer arts camp. In early 2015, officials announced the city of Raleigh would purchase the 308-acre Dorothea Dix campus for $52 million. Some big-name executives in the area put their influence behind closing the deal. They created a vision for a new city-owned park after the closure 5 years ago of Dix Hospital in Raleigh in favor of a new mental health hospital in Butner. Now comes another name, Sean Malone, as the new president and CEO of Dix Park Conservancy. He is spearheading the effort to create a world-class destination park on the property. Triangle Business Journal caught up with Malone to get his thoughts on the future of Dick's Park and his first impression of the Triangle, his new home. How long have you been in the Triangle? My family and I are in the process of moving here. We expect to be here in our new home and community by mid-March, and we can't wait. Tell us about Dick's Park Conservancy. Dick's Park Conservancy is a nonprofit organization that exists to support the city of Raleigh and help ensure the success and use of a spectacular urban park that will enhance the daily lives of all community residents and become a crown jewel for North Carolina. The organization was created just last year, representing the strategic collaboration of the leadership of three Dick's Park advocacy groups, the Dick's Visionaries, Dick's 306, and Friends of Dick's Park, as well as other engaged civic and business leaders. What are your initial goals in your new post? My initial goals are about listening. What this community has done to make this endeavor possible is exciting and inspirational. I am deeply impressed by Mayor Nancy McFarlane and City Council and the incredible staff at the City of Raleigh. As an initial goal, I want to listen to them and learn how they feel the Conservancy can best support their work and leadership. I am equally impressed by the community and business leaders and volunteers who are so committed to successfully creating a world-class urban park that will have profound impact. I want to learn what this project means to them, what they believe it can accomplish, how they feel this endeavor can meaningfully enrich the quality of life of everyone who lives in this community and region. Dick's Park is one of the most exciting projects in the country right now. In addition to serving this region directly, this endeavor is going to shine a well-deserved national spotlight on this region and on everything it has to offer. How did you hear about this post? When I heard about the position, I was not actively looking to move. After wrapping up my tenure at the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation, I was offering in-depth consulting to nonprofits. My family and I were rooted in our home in the Midwest, and I was very much enjoying my work. Then a colleague sent me the posting for this role. He said that I was either going to love him or hate him, but that I had to read about this project, and he was right. What most attracted you to this role? I was moved by the public benefit impact this project can have and by the level of civic and community support it has. I was excited about the entrepreneurial nature of the endeavor, how much there is to build and create in collaboration with internal stakeholders and external partners. And my wife and I had often talked about the Triangle area as a region that appealed to us as a place to live. So I was intrigued by the opportunity on paper, very intrigued, but the certainty came when I started talking with the people involved in this project. They have a rare mix of vision, warmth, focus, intelligence, generosity, and desire to create something truly meaningful. Have you had any similar experiences to this in your past? For the past 20 years, I've had the honor to lead entrepreneurial nonprofits that steward and celebrate a deep sense of place, from the National Historic Landmark, 10 Chimneys, 60 acres of Kettle Moraine in Wisconsin, to the diverse 1,300-plus acres of Frank Lloyd Wright's Tailson West in Arizona and Tailson in Wisconsin. As president and CEO of the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation, I was proud to lead and manage a storied and complex institution and preservation of two of the most revered architectural sites in the world. As president of 10 Chimneys Foundation, I had the rare privilege of building a historic site organization as a true startup. What are your proudest professional accomplishments at those two organizations you've mentioned? I've never considered the accomplishments of the organizations I've had the opportunity to lead as mine. My role is one of service. During my 4 years at the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation, the trustee and staff teams and I were able to build the internal capacity to sustain programmatic impact and revenue growth for decades to come. During my 15-year tenure at 10 Chimneys Foundation, the organization grew from a two-person startup to a multifaceted organization, a world-class historic site, and a national resource for theater and the arts. And we'll stop there as we run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.